the 17th of June 2015 and it's 15:20. I wonder if you could just say your name and also your degree and your class year.
Bob Weinberg. My degree is a PhD, which I received at in 1960. My years at the school in residence were 1953 to 55. And I completed the thesis while I was serving in the U.S. Army and while I was attending Yale Law School, and came back and took the oral exam in 1960. My tutor was Ben Roberts, who was the professor of trade union studies. And then they later changed the name of the department to Industrial Relations, I believe. But when I was with him, he was the head of trade union studies.
Just a little bit of background. Could you tell us where you were born and brought up?
When or where?
Where?
In New York City. I was born May 23rd, 1931. Brought up in New York. Went to a progressive grade school, which followed the philosophy of John Dewey, learning by doing. Then I went to Stuyvesant High School in New York, which is one of the best public high schools in the state, public in the American sense of the term. The school's been around for over 100 years. And I was fortunate to finish first in the class at the school and first in the New York State on the statewide annual scholarship, region scholarship exam that as they called it, and I was president of the student body at Stuyvesant High School.
So, having been born and brought up in New York City, how do you end up at LSE?
Well, I from Stuyvesant High School, I went to Yale. In those days, it was much harder to get into the Ivy schools if you were Jewish. I was fortunate to make their quota. They, at the time, they denied they had quotas, but later in the 60s, they admitted that they had had a quota system. And these were quotas not to get a minimum, but to keep a maximum number. So their quota for Jewish students was 10%. For Catholic students, it was 11%. And there were very few black students. There were some. My freshman class at Yale had, I believe, five black students out of over 1,000 students in the class. These policies have changed dramatically, and now I think they're free of racial and religious quotas and indeed make particular efforts to attract African-American students, which is a great improvement in the admissions policy that I confronted. So I considered myself fortunate to have gotten into Yale and to Harvard, and I chose Yale.
And then you did your degree at Yale?
Yes, I did my LLB, my BA at Yale. I was a history major. I was very active in an organization called the Yale Political Union, which was copied and actually had, I think, joint membership with the Oxford and Cambridge unions. They copied it from their format, and at least in theory, if you were a member of the Yale Political Union, you could also attend the Oxford or Cambridge Union. And in fact, when I was at LSE, I was invited to debate at the Cambridge Union, so I was able to use my joint membership. As I recall, the debate was on the topic resolved that the British, like all good dogs, have had their day. I believe that I and a Northern Ireland speaker were given the affirmative. The negative, which of course won that audience, included, as I recall, Michael Heseltine as one of the speakers. And I got to LSE because after I graduated from Yale, I was fortunate enough to get a Fulbright scholarship. I think the Fulbright program is still going today. It was named after Senator Fulbright, who introduced the legislation to get it established. And it provided for American students to attend foreign schools, and I believe the source of the funding was actually the so-called counterpart funds, which the foreign governments owed to the U.S. in return for the dollar expenditures that they had received in aid. So the grant was in pounds. It covered the tuition at LSE, which I think in those days was something like £17 a term for each of the three terms, and it covered the room and board at Passfield Hall. I had asked as our request to get rooming facilities on campus so that I would be meeting the British students and not just fellow Americans. And Passfield turned out to be an extremely cosmopolitan place. I think we must have had 10 or 12 different nationalities living in Passfield, which at the time I believe was the only hall of residence for men. Well, I guess my first impression was getting a ration card when I came to the LSE Hall of Residence. Food rationing was still in effect. And my impression of the school was very favorable one, because the first people I met were Ann Bohm, who was for many years the secretary of the postgraduate department, I guess it was called. I think it was often thought in later days she would have been dean of the whole graduate school if she were male, but in those days they didn't want to give the title to a woman, perhaps. But she ran the graduate school, the program, for generations, I think. And she suggested that I have as my tutor Ben Roberts. In my application as to why I wanted to go to LSE, I said I was interested in studying the trade union movement, and I've been interested in that in my work at Yale, where I was in my senior year in a so-called Scholar of the House program, where you spent your senior year writing one long paper, and I did my paper on the history of the socialist movement in the United States from Robert Owen through up to 1953 when I was writing the paper. And I was, of course, a lot of that involved history of the labor movement. And my interest after college, I planned to go to law school, as I did. I planned to go to Yale Law School, was admitted to Yale Law School and deferred my admission to permit me to spend this year at LSE. After my first year, toward the end of my first year, my tutor, Ben Roberts, suggested that I apply to get the grant extended for a second year, and that would qualify me to get a PhD. It was just a residence requirement of 2 years, and unlike the American universities, which at the time required years of preliminary exams and foreign language exams and the like to get a PhD, none of that encumbered people seeking PhDs in England. And although I had no professional need for a PhD for the field I was going into, academically it was, and intellectually it was a great challenge. Then after one completed the 2 years of residence, taking whatever courses you wanted, I ordered a great variety of courses, including law courses, economics courses, political science courses. And among my teachers was Ralph Miliband, who turned out became a very important figure in the life of the school. And his one of our classmates at the school was Marion Kosak, who later married Professor Miliband and is the mother of the two great Milibands who have been such good, great figures in British politics, and I trust will continue to be. But one of the exciting things at the school was you never knew who would do this, but you could feel you were at a school which was producing leaders not only in England but throughout the world. Some of them would have to, in between, spend time in jail in one of the African countries rebelling against colonial rule, and after serving the time in jail would end up as Prime Minister or other officials of the government, and LSE certainly had that great tradition. One of the things that struck me was how cosmopolitan the school was. There were certainly hundreds of students from India, Pakistan, and Africa, particularly Nigeria and Ghana, as I recall.
What was it like being a PhD student at that time?
I don't think there were a lot of PhD students. They didn't group us or anything. There was a graduate studies hall. I think like room 301, I think, was the student, the undergraduate common room, and 401 was the graduate common room. But I don't recall that there was any grouping of the PhD students. And the ones in the graduate hall might be doing a PhD, might be doing an MSc, or might just be doing independent study. And I believe one of the future directors of the school was there at the same time, but we didn't. It was German. We didn't, I think, actually meet, is that I recall. I think the thing I most recall about the my graduate experience was winning the chess championship of the school.
And
I can't remember. I can remember the game, but Budapest Defense, I can't remember his name.
And what was Ben Roberts like as a supervisor?
Ben Roberts was just a great supervisor. Ben had been from a labor background. He was very open and encouraging. He had great contacts in the labor movement. I think one of the first things I did when I got to LSE, since it was the time of the party conferences, it was in September, early October, I went to the Labor Party conference, which I think was in Margate, and also to the Conservative Party conference, which may have been in the same place, I recall. And I also went to a TUC conference, which Ben helped me get access to. And we remained friends for life after we were at the schools. From time to time, Ben and his wife would stay with us in the U.S. while Ben was attending conferences in the U.S. And after I left LSE, I was at law school, and then we had uniform military service at the time. While I was at law school, I was inducted for 2 years into the Army. And fortunately, one of those years, Ben was on sabbatical in the U.S. at Princeton, so I was able to confer with him on my thesis, which I was writing in my off-duty hours in the service. Fortunately, it was peacetime, so there wasn't great stress, and I also wrote some of the thesis while I was at law school, and the thesis was basically on the history of ideas of industrial democracy and workers' control in the labor movement, both the Trades Union Congress and the Labor Party, and also groups such as the Guild Socialists, who were very well known at the time. But I found in studying the movement that after the Labor Party came to power and come to power, it nationalized the industries, and it greatly improved working conditions for the workers. But one of the first things that seemed to go by the way was the old ideas of workers' control. They did have some development of industrial consultation, but they didn't follow, for instance, the German model of co-determination, where the workers had a say in running the industry. Yes, Robson, a government teacher, had a seminar on governors, excellent seminar, and as I recall, he would occasionally invite the class or group of students over to his home. He was very hospitable. I think English local government was perhaps his most special field, and actually when I was at law school and working on the Yale Law Journal, which is, like most schools, it's a publication put out by the students, written in part by the students. Some articles are contributed by academic faculty, but the students would write something, and I wrote my so-called comment about an English case, the Bonsor case. I think maybe Bonsor one of the unions, and it raised the issue of whether unions are juridical persons or just associations of individuals. And as I recall, Bonsor held they were juridical persons, and I tried to apply that idea to American law, saying unions should be considered juridical persons for purposes of determining citizenship. In U.S. litigation, your case would be in federal court if it were between citizens of different states. If you had a union, then it would be or an association, the citizenship of each individual member would count. So it would be unlikely you would have the required complete diversity between all the members of a union and, say, an employer. But if unions were treated as juridical persons like corporations, and as I learned, as they were, I think, in Roman Dutch law as well as under the Bonsor decision in England, it would be advantageous, I thought, to the unions. And there was a lawyer who took up that theory, I think won a case on it in the lower court. The other side appealed to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court rejected the theory and held that the unions were not to be considered citizens for diversity purposes. But it was very exciting to do that kind of research, both in England and then at Yale Law School. No, I was president of the Students' Union, and my wife was general secretary. At that time, the chief officer of the union was the president. And the general secretary was, of course, the general secretary. In subsequent years, I understood, I think starting in the 60s, the general secretary became the chief officer, I guess on the trade union model, where the chief officer of a trade union would be the general secretary.
So what was your role as general secretary? Did you have to negotiate as president?
Well, as president, you would preside over the weekly meetings of the students' union. It's very democratic. The union met every Thursday afternoon. The council, which consisted of, I believe, was seven union officers, president, three vice presidents, with one for welfare, one for social relations, and one for international relations. And there was a general secretary and a treasurer, and the council would meet regularly, and just you would be doing the affairs of any student government, planning events, social events, events with guest speakers, and the union in particular was able to attract a very interesting array of guest speakers. Being in London, I remember, for instance, we had the Red Dean of Canterbury, who was at the time outspoken, and he undertook the challenge of speaking here. I think we had conservative, labor, and communist speakers at one time or another at the union. The union debates were very spirited. There were some very excellent conservative speakers. I can call one of them Bob Johnson, who I think has been a high court judge for many years now, Alan Tyrrell, who unfortunately passed away a year ago, but had become a leading barrister and a MEP, member of the European Parliament. There were the Liberal Party, although it was small, was very outspoken, and they had some very good speakers. I think the name Alan Watkins is one that occurred to me. The Labour Party had a number of excellent speakers. One that comes to mind is Vishu Sharma, who was, I believe, from Kenya. John Martin, who was the president of the union before I was. Gideon Ben Israel, who was president of the union at the time I started at LSE in October of 1953. Michael Thomas, who is here at today's reunion, was another one of the excellent speakers. And there was a very eloquent communist speaker named Colin Sweet, who I think spent many years at the school. We all sort of wondered what he kept on studying. But he was a very articulate spokesman. And in later years, I gathered, probably it was after the Hungarian uprising, he left the party and became a leading figure in the environmental movement in England. And I was, I guess, told by somebody who went to the funeral, I think by John Martin, that all the people at the funeral service and memorial service spoke about his environmental work, but most of them had been unaware of his previous background as a communist leader, I guess not just at LSE, but in whatever he did in that party outside of LSE. But everything was very friendly on a personal basis. So political differences did not in any ways affect or deter from personal friendships. I mean, one of my closest friends who ran today's reunion was Bob Williams, who was active in the Conservative Party at LSE. And I think the best thing that happened to me was living at Passfield Hall because of meeting such a diversity of students, including, for instance, Bob Williams and Bob Potter, who were both here at today's reunion. And I think it was partly because Passfield was such a unifying factor that these periodic reunions of the group from class of 54 and 53, 55, today I guess it was 52 to 56, has remained such a cohesive group over the years. And Passfield was a great bonding experience. The warden was Raymond Chapman, who I think was warden there for probably at least 25 years. I recall his field was English, teaching English, so that he was not by and large in the same academic field as the students who were living in Passfield. It would have economics, political science, or law, but he was just a wonderful warden. Well, there wasn't a large campus. There was this building, the old building, and there was what was called the new building across the street. And I think that was about it. I forget the exact location of the library. The library, of course, is a very important part of the school. But we've admired the building that's gone on over the years, and particularly the Watson it's called the Watson part of the campus, the
plaza,
is it? And I believe Watson was my wife's tutor. And but there was no campus of that type when we were here. Coming from Yale, which had had a campus, although it was still urban, it was quite a contrast, but it had all the advantages of living in London and this access to everywhere. So we didn't miss the fact there was a campus, or there wasn't a campus of the kind we've been used to, but the campus here was more limited in its structure. But it was a very friendly place. I mean, they seemed to find space for all the student activities and other academic and non-academic activities, but we've admired its growth as it happens. My wife, Wendy, whom I met here as a student, has been on the governing body of LSE for many years till she aged out at 75. So we were in touch over the years with the growth of the school and the growth of the premises. But I don't think it's anything we would have imagined coming about when we were at the school. No, I don't think it had changed. I think it was later in the 60s that it changed greatly, in the years where there was a lot of controversy, I gather, this school and most others. But in 1960, I didn't notice a change. On the other hand, it was the summer, so that when I came back for it, so I wouldn't have seen as much activity as if I'd been here during the main part of
did
the academic year.
Did you actually graduate for your PhD in the end?
Well, did I go to a ceremony?
Yeah.
I think the ceremony was a year later, and I think I did go. Though in those days, I think there were probably people often didn't go because it wasn't held immediately after the coursework was completed. I believe I went once as president of the union to the graduation.
And just a final question, because you mentioned that you
The leading university in the world in the economic and political and law disciplines, and many others that grow from those. Sociology, of course, I think was not quite invented at LSE, but it probably was the premier sociological training ground in the academic world at that time. And I guess a lot of the faculty were German refugees who contributed immensely. I remember going to Professor Con Freund's lectures, and then he also taught at Yale Law School, so I would sometimes see him in his rotation there. But it was great being able to just audit courses. I started out as, I guess it was called, a general full course student, so you could go to anything. There were no exams for the general full course people, so you weren't under any pressure except what you generated yourself.
Okay. Well, thank you. Is there anything else you'd like to tell us about?
Oh, well, I've been very pleased to be associated with the school over these years. Obviously, it's been a major part of my life since it's where I met my spouse, Wendy. December 1953, and we're approaching our 59th wedding anniversary this summer. We were married, and after Wendy had graduated, we were married in 1956. And then we went through Yale Law School together, and the combination of Stuyvesant High School, Yale College, and law school, and the LSE, I think, has given me as good an education as I could hope to get anywhere. It's been a very pleasant and rewarding part of life to have had these years at the LSE, and to have kept in touch with the school since and seen it grow and develop.
Thank you.